Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Towns and counties in New York State will soon hold their elections in even-numbered years. As the New York Public News Network's John Campbell reports, that's thanks to a ruling from the state's top court this week.
Republican-led counties argued a state law moving their local elections from odd years to even years violated the state constitution. But the Court of Appeals upheld the law and declined to delay it. Now, races for town supervisor and county executive will gradually shift to even number years, aligning them with state and federal elections. But city elections are set in odd years by the state constitution. New York City voters will decide next month whether to pre-authorize a move to even years. But it would only take effect if the state changes the constitution. The earliest that could happen is late 2027. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
In a move that stunned local officials, MGM Resorts pulled Empire City Casino in Yonkers from the race for a limited number of casino licenses in New York this week. The sudden reversal has the city's mayor calling for an investigation into whether President Donald Trump could have influenced the decision. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
MGM says it no longer believes it will see the return on investment it expected when it first submitted its application for a full gaming license in June. New York is set to award up to 3 gaming licenses to downstate locations by the end of the year. MGM had proposed a $2.3 billion project to transform Empire City from a slot machine parlor into a full-scale gambling venue with restaurants and entertainment. But with 3 other proposals also vying for licenses in New York City, MGM says it is no longer sure whether an upgraded Yonkers casino could compete. The resort's chain also listed new state guidance that would have qualified them for only a 15-year license, rather than the 30-year license they were expecting.
For 2 straight years, we were a partner, and at the last minute, the plug was pulled.
Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano isn't buying it. Speaking with WAMC, the Democrat acknowledges the switch up from a 30-year license to a 15-year term was sudden. He says they got the news from the state about 6 days ago, but he doesn't understand why MGM would pull the plug before talking to him first. He says the chain's other concerns about competition have always been something they were able to talk through. Instead of calling him before a 4 p.m. paperwork deadline Tuesday, however, Spano says MGM called him after the deadline to say the project was dead.
I'm really disappointed that MGM pulled the rug out from under us, and I'm suspect in the fact of the way it was done. They chose to tell us after it was too late.
Spano is calling on New York Governor Kathy Hochul to launch an independent investigation into whether MGM faced any pressure to withdraw or whether there was any, quote, linkage between MGM's decision and the massive financial benefit to Donald Trump, end quote. One of the remaining bids, Bally's in the Bronx, is at the site of a former Trump golf course. Bally's bought the license to operate the property from the Trump Organization in 2023. As part of that deal, Bally's agreed to pay the Trump Organization $115 million in the event the site was turned into a casino.
So that makes me wonder, well, what's going on? That's why I've asked the governor to please investigate this matter.
WAMC has reached out to the White House for comment. MGM declined to comment beyond its announcement Tuesday. Spano is not the only local official who is skeptical of MGM's decision. In a statement Tuesday, Westchester County Executive Ken Jenkins, a fellow Democrat, said he shares Spano's concern, adding, quote, frankly, this decision makes little sense, end quote. Asked about the situation this morning, however, Hochul says she's not ready to open an investigation.
I share the mayor's disappointment that this did not continue, but I, at this time, am not aware of any reason to launch an investigation. I have no evidence to suspect that there's any wrongdoing in this decision-making. I think MGM knows, you know, they made their own probably financial decision based on what their needs are. And so, you know, the process will move forward with the 3 bidders at this point, and we know how that's likely to go.
In past conversations with WAMC, Mayor Spano was very optimistic about Yonkers' odds of winning one of the three licenses, calling it a, quote, sure bet. The project's Community Advisory Committee unanimously approved MGM's plan last month. The project was expected to bring hundreds of jobs and tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue to the city of Yonkers. MGM had also agreed to a $100 million community benefits agreement to mitigate traffic concerns around the casino and improve stormwater drainage in the area. Spano says the plan also included funds to construct a new library. The future of Empire City is now murky. In announcing its decision Tuesday, MGM says it remains committed to operating Empire City in its current form. Throughout the application process, however, Spano says the chain described the upgrades as crucial to the casino's long-term survival. Before approving the plan last month, Community Advisory Committee Chair James Kavanaugh warned Empire City would, quote, wither and die without a full gaming license.
With three new casinos within a half-hour drive, all offering table games, sports betting, entertainment, and all that goes with a full-blown casino, who is going to continue going to an aging slot parlor that has none of these things?
Spano says he doesn't understand why MGM would effectively sign the, quote, death warrant of its own casino. He's hopeful but concerned for the future of the site.
I will say this, it's a valuable piece of property, probably the most valuable piece of property that exists between Manhattan and Albany. Yonkers will be okay, but we negotiated in good faith, and MGM pulled the rug out from under us, and we want to know why.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
New York City mayoral candidates Andrew Cuomo and Republican Curtis Sliwa took aim at Democrat Zohran Mamdani's momentum during a highly combative first general election debate this week. Mamdani, a 33-year-old Democratic socialist, defeated Cuomo in the Democratic primaries and is now the frontrunner to lead New York City. Sliwa and newly independent candidate Cuomo spent a majority of the debate questioning Mamdani's ability to lead America's biggest city, painting his agenda as too ambitious.
This is no job for on-the-job training. Any day, you could have a hurricane, you could have, God forbid, a 9/11, a health pandemic. If you don't know
Thank
what
you,
you're
Mr.
doing,
Cuomo.
People could
and
die.
Sir Mamdani, yeah. Do you want to respond?
And if we have a health pandemic, then why would New Yorkers turn back to the governor who sent seniors to their death in nursing homes? That's the kind of experience that's on offer here today. What I don't have in experience, I make up for in integrity. And what you don't have in integrity, you could never make up for in experience.
Yeah. We have Andrew Cuomo. We have Zohran Mamdani. They want to take on Donald Trump. Look, you can be tough, but you can't be tough if it's going to cost people desperately needed federal funds. Zohran Mamdani, the president has already said, he's going to take $7 billion out of the budget right from the start if you're elected mayor.
I don't think in any way the assemblyman is representative of the Muslim community.
You know, it took Andrew Cuomo being beaten by a Muslim candidate in the Democratic primary for him to set foot in a mosque.
The New York City mayoral election will be held November 4th. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Manager for Compassion and Choices, which has worked for a decade to pass the Medical Aid in Dying Act. It now sits before the governor, Kathy Hochul. I asked Corinne Carey whether she thinks the governor will sign the bill.
Well, David, every single day I get at least a dozen phone calls, many more emails asking me why hasn't the governor acted yet after these 10 long years of making improvements to this bill? And, you know, I'm of two minds here. One, it's not entirely out of the ordinary for the governor to be taking this long, particularly on a consequential bill. I know that many of my colleagues who do legislative advocacy are waiting for the governor to sign other important pieces of legislation. I know that over 900 bills, I think it was anywhere between 850 and 900 bills were passed by the legislature and await her signature. So it's not entirely out of the ordinary. On the other hand, time moves very differently for someone who has a limited amount of time left. And so for a terminally ill person to know that it could be 2 more months or 2.5 more months before the governor acts is excruciatingly painful for them to imagine having to deal with these illnesses. Sometimes these scans come 2 months apart. We could have, you know, the 7 who came to Albany last week take a nosedive 2 months from now and not know whether this is going to be an option for them. These are human lives. These are not poll numbers. These are not facts or figures. These are people that are looking to the governor to make, as she says, the right decision. And the right decision for New York is to sign this bill and allow everyone to have the kind of death that is fitting for the kind of lives that we've led.
Well, one of the common examples that's been used, I've even brought it up with you in the past, Corinne Carey, is the idea that when it comes to our pets, the animals that we love, when they're in a situation like this and they're going to have a painful end of life, we immediately seek to, quote, put them down. Now, that language probably doesn't sound good when you talk about human beings, but either way, these are sentient beings and they're in pain. And we would do it for, you know, the pet and see nothing wrong with that.
Well, I'd say a few things about that. You're right, but it doesn't sound quite good. And I remember that we had a supporter who felt very strongly about this and had a sign in the hallway at the Capitol during the time that the legislature was deliberating this bill. And there were a number of lawmakers who took great offense to this notion because they believe, not everyone does, they believe that animals don't have souls. They believe that animals are very different from people and that people shouldn't be treated as animals. But I think about something that one of the veterinarians that is among our supporter base said to me once, and he took it a step further and said, not only do we not allow our pets to suffer when they are in pain at the end of their lives, we would be charged with animal cruelty if we allowed a pet to starve to death the way that we allow families to do so. And so I understand that this is a difficult argument for some people. Many, many, many of our supporters and many people in rural New York who are farmers, who deal with livestock and agriculture, they understand this deeply. That's why our support numbers are so strong in rural areas in New York State. You know, the fact is, we're not making this decision for other people like we do our pets. All we're doing is putting the power to determine what your end-of-life experience looks like in the hands of the dying person, where it belongs. No family member, no doctor, no hospice can make the decision that someone uses medical aid in dying. Only the dying person can do that.
Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Manager for Compassion and Choices, which has worked for a decade to pass the Medical Aid in Dying Act. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. At a time when Democrats and Republicans are failing to find ways to cooperate at the local, regional, and national levels of government, a rural community is experiencing a surge of bipartisanship. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor has the story.
Joe Giebelhaus never thought he would be involved in politics, but that changed when 3 of the 5 all-Republican Burn Town board members resigned last year, crippling the town's local government.
I had no intention of getting into government at all.
Giebelhaus, a Burn resident, served as the City of Albany's deputy commissioner of the Department of General Services before retiring in January.
One day, about 6 weeks into my retirement, I turned on the news and I saw a town of Burn suing Kathy Hochul. And I said, what's going on? What's going on in my little town here? I had no idea. I had no thoughts whatsoever. I wasn't even paying attention to the world.
To find out more, Giebelhaus says he went to Maple on the Lake, a bar in Burn where, quote, everyone knows everyone else, to find out more. Giebelhaus says he asked Albany County legislator Chris Smith, who works at the bar, why the town was suing Governor Kathy Hochul.
And he told me the story about how the town had shut down because 3 council members had quit. And the town was suing the governor's office in order to make the appointments so we can get the town up and running again. So I immediately volunteered. just out of good citizenship, I said, well, I volunteered to be on the town board.
The Democrat, who has now been a member of the Byrne Town Board for about 6 months, is running for town supervisor in the upcoming November elections. And in a rare display of bipartisanship, Giebel House has been endorsed by the Byrne Democratic and Republican committees. Two other local candidates, Highway Superintendent candidate Alan Stemple and Town Board candidate Scott Duncan, also carry endorsements by both parties. While the local races also feature several candidates who only have single-party backing, Byrne Democratic Committee Chair and Tax Collector candidate James Kaufman says his party had no problem cross-endorsing candidates.
Both parties realize that we need to fix things, and there's no sense in playing, you know, political favorites when you know you got people out there that can do the job, and they're willing to do the job, and they're willing to be cross-endorsed.
Kaufman, Giebelhaus, and the town's Republican committee chair, Joe Martin, say the town's fiscal position is one of the biggest issues facing Byrne. Martin was one of the three board members that resigned last year.
The issues that we had in town and have today is they're not a political affiliation issue. It's a people issue with a very, very small part of our community that wants to continue to go to war for self-serving reasons, in my opinion. So our town was in financial trouble, still is slowly digging itself out of a hole.
The party chairs also contend that the three cross-endorsed candidates are the best people for the job.
I've got full faith in everybody on our ticket.
Giebel House is hoping to continue working in a bipartisan fashion if he wins in November. He says some of his priorities would be to change the way the budget is developed and bring more government business into the town by way of contracts. As for the bipartisanship, Giebel House has some advice for those looking to work with colleagues across the aisle.
Remember that once you've taken that oath, who you're working for. You're no longer working for the party. You're no longer working for your own personal agenda, whatever that might be. You're working for everyone. You're working for all the taxpayers.
I'm Jesse Taylor.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Well, let's talk about another Legislative Gazette for a minute and the history that involves this program as well. The Legislative Gazette is actually a newspaper that covers the New York State Legislature. It is a New Paltz production and for years was run by the CEO of WAMC and Professor Emeritus, Dr. Alan Chartok. In the waning years, the Gazette remained. It was all online and stopped for a brief period of time. But now it's back. And boy, am I excited about this. With us today is Darren Johnson, new head of the project, along with two of his students. And boy, are they the future of journalism. We're talking about Benjamin Nellis and Nancy McInnes. Welcome to all of you on this week's Legislative Gazette.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Darren Johnson, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became involved in this particular project. I know in many ways you're quite the entrepreneur. You're involved in newspaper publications, not just the Legislative Gazette, but explain to people how you ended up here.
Yeah, I've melded the worlds of education, journalism education, and being a practitioner. I own some rural newspapers out near where I live, the Greenwich Journal and the Salem Press, which we separated out into two separate papers. They had been combined for a while. We just started a Fort Edward paper up there. But all the while, you know, you got to pay the bills. The media business isn't what it used to be. And I enjoy it a lot. I've worked at colleges. So just before this, I did a 3-year stint. That was the contract at Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. And I ran the school paper, the radio station there. And taught journalism courses. That opportunity ended, and this opportunity opened up. And this is something I think that fits what I do almost exactly. I'm a practitioner, and we're going to get the Legislative Gazette back in good standing, maybe get a print edition back, and do a lot of those things. But also it's an educational experience. The students are getting credit. They're coming from New Paltz to Albany, and we want to expand the program to other SUNYs as well.
Yeah, and, you know, that's really the most important part of this project, the educational component, in terms of giving students a real-world experience covering the legislature. I can tell you from my past experience as a teaching assistant through SUNY and working with some of these young people, we've seen Pulitzer Prize winners come out of the Legislative Gazette in their future professional jobs. And, you know, it hasn't been unknown for the Legislative Gazette to break a few stories of their own over the time because you are literally working in the state capitol. It also is in the history of the Legislative Gazette that at one point they didn't want it. Why do we have to have it? Let's kill it. But through the efforts of Ann Erickson and others at that time, they drew attention to the plot to kill the Gazette, and it was saved. Saved by none other than former Governor Mario M. Cuomo. So when you look at the history of newspapering, even on the student level, it can be under threat. And as we're seeing that right now, Darren, before I go to you, students, I just wanted to ask you about that. With the climate that's out there now, not only the difficulty for print and gaining subscriptions and, mm-hmm. and keeping them and getting money for their work, you know, you've said, I'm going to bring back the print version. But there is an opportunity at the Capitol for that, isn't there?
There definitely is. People who haven't been to the Capitol, it has a huge footprint and has a whole concourse that is kind of like a huge shopping mall. During the legislative season, which starts in the winter, it's packed with people. So we could put racks all throughout the Capitol, and as a free paper, it could be picked up. So looking forward to that. I was frankly surprised at the reputation the Legislative Gazette still has. It's 47 years old, and people still know what it is. It had been a print edition in the past, so we're not reinventing the wheel. It had been one, and then it stopped printing around 2017-ish or so. But we'd like to bring that back. I think the legislators would like to see a newspaper. A lot of them don't have newspapers in their districts anymore because newspapers have been falling by the wayside. So this could be the paper, and they can compete to get in it.
Yeah, and to your point about revenue, there are so many lobbying organizations, both good government lobbying groups and others, that want their message to get out. And one of the things that was able to sustain the Gazette for so long was advertisements from these groups.
Yeah, and we're going to distribute it also directly to all the legislators, too. They each have a mailbox outside their office. And, you know, what better way to reach all the legislators at a good price than to buy an ad in the Legislative Gazette?
Darren Johnson, who is now heading up the project, the Legislative Gazette newspaper. And, you know, part of what happened, young people, was at the time, the reason that the Legislative Gazette radio show exists is because in addition to the newspaper, Dr. Shartok used to bring the group up every week and record this program, the Legislative Gazette, and it simply was a debrief. He'd sit and go around the table and ask each reporter to tell him, what are you working on today and what can we expect from you in the paper? So that's the origin of this very program. Now, I want to start with you, Nancy McGinnis. First, tell us, where are you in your education? How come the Legislative Gazette? And as you and I were talking before coming on air, this particular interest in radio?
All right. My name is, as we mentioned before, Nancy McGinnis. I'm a senior currently at SUNY New Paltz, and I'm a journalism major and a psychology minor. I actually used to be a double minor in theater arts and psychology, but I ended up solely switching to psych in that minor, which I do greatly enjoy and find it actually helps me a lot in my journalism and being in the multimedia field to like be able to understand and read people very well. I also currently am writing a little bit of a piece on a local musician, not for the Gazette, but I'm doing it for another publication that I'm a part of, which is The Little Rebellion. I also, as we mentioned before, am very interested in radio. I've been part of WFMP Radio for SUNY New Paltz for the past 2.5 years as a reader and a writer. And about a year and a half ago now, I got promoted to being our co-news director and also learned how to do engineering and took more of a management side. And I'm very grateful for the hands-on experience I gained being a part of this organization, along with all of the new people I got to meet and the networking experience I have gained from being in this as well. I would not be where I am today without college radio. It has had such a huge impact on my life. And also, I enjoy reading the news. I enjoy getting to write the scripts every day and getting to see what's going on locally and then getting to help others pick up on it and learn about it. And then seeing how excited we all get for the little news broadcasts that we have like in our round tables or even in the semester prior to this, I was the person in charge of our Friday night interviews. We currently are doing student like op-eds like student journalist from SUNY New Paltz for the Oracle publication. But in the past, what I was doing for the Friday segment was getting faculty members and interviewing them for events they are planning and hosting on campus. And we had convocation in February of last year, and I hosted one of the members who created the whole convocation event live in the studio. And that was a very rewarding experience to do. And I'm very grateful to have, like I mentioned before, gained that hands-on experience from it.
Nancy, they can't see my face here, but I've got a Cheshire Cat grin on. When I see young people as an adjunct professor at UAlbany so excited, understanding the importance of not only radio but journalism and so wanting to be involved, that just gives me hope. And I know that Darren Johnson certainly feels that as well. But I'm afraid we're out of time for this week's program. So let's agree to come back next week for part two. We'll talk to you, Nancy, a little bit more. We'll have a nice conversation with you, Benjamin, about your interest in this career. And we'll even share some potential new opportunities for students with the Legislative Gazette going forward. Darren, Nancy, Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And a reminder, stay tuned for part two next week. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2542. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.